Welcome to the Missing Ingredient Podcast from Secret Sauce. I'm Brendan.
And I'm Zach.
And we'll be your hosts. In this series, we interview industry professionals, entrepreneurs, and recruiters to give job seekers the insider knowledge they need to break into tech. Thanks for joining us, and I hope you enjoy the show. In this episode, we interview Jamie Kent. Jamie is a software engineer at Parabola. Parabola is a really interesting startup based in SF that is building products to give knowledge workers the capabilities of engineers. Jamie is fascinating. She is a UPenn alum, Fulbright scholar, and all-around badass person. In our conversation, we talked about how Jamie's Fulbright research scholarship took her to South America, where she did research and helped teach Chilean youths computer science fundamentals. We also got into how she transitioned into software engineering without a computer science background, as well as the nonprofit she co-founded called Women in Sports Tech, which aims to provide growth opportunities for women in the sports tech industry. We had a lot of fun recording this, so please enjoy our conversation with Jamie Kent. Jamie, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
No, thank you. Zach and I are really excited about this conversation. You have a really interesting story. You are someone who did not study a technical major in college, but you are now a software engineer in Silicon Valley. And I personally think you have a very unique story, and you took a very unconventional path to getting where you are today, which I think is awesome. So on that note, I want to start by talking about Chile. You spent some time in Chile. Could you tell me a little bit more about why you ended up moving to Chile and specifically how you got there?
Sure. So I had always wanted to live abroad at some point. And once I heard about the Fulbright grant, which is, if you haven't heard of it, it's a State Department grant, and it allows any person, or it's usually college grads or someone recently graduated, to design a research proposal and get funding to go do it in another country. So once I heard that was an option, I started writing grant proposals, and I had worked at my first tech startup. So my proposal was teaching computer science in Chile in public high schools, where Chile was really trying to build this tech sector and attract entrepreneurs from all over the world. And so my proposal really focused on building talent in Chile and getting high schools set up so that they were introducing programming to students at a really young age. And so that kind of pulled me down to Chile. And then I got stuck because it's such an amazing, gorgeous country. And I freelanced there for a while and started working on a nonprofit.
That's awesome. And I definitely want to get to your nonprofit. But before we do, I'm curious what the process was for the Fulbright scholarship application. Like, what did you need to outline exactly what the program would be and who you'd be working with, or what did that process look like?
Yep, that's a great question. So you send in a grant proposal. It's 2 pages, single spaced, so not a lot of room to really go into detail of what you're going to do. But you high level outline the phases of your research project, the organization that will be sponsoring you or mentoring you throughout your project. That can be an academic institution or kind of a nonprofit type thing. And I worked with Universidad de Santiago down there. And for me, I think a misconception with Fulbright is that everyone who does research was working on this research in college or already had this project lined up and in their mind for a long time. But I kind of worked backwards from, I want to go work in another country. What am I qualified to do? And how can I make this happen? So I was always interested in education and didn't have as much experience in that space, but I knew kind of the tech piece. And so I put those two together, and working with my university, my undergraduate university, put together a proposal that, and we just kept iterating until we felt like it was something that was competitive. And yeah, I think I actually wrote two proposals, one for Peru, one for Chile, and then we like mashed them together and it kind of evolved into this final thing. So you can kind of design your own research project from scratch. And then you also get a letter of affiliation, recommendations from your college professors and people you've worked with. And I think that's it. Oh, and a language assessment. So I had a tutor who was able to do that for me.
That's amazing. And when you say we, were you working with other people on this particular grant, or was this like a solo mission?
This was, when I say we, it's because I involved all of my friends who are great writers or worked in the space to help me write the proposal. But I designed the research project and then reached out to the university in Chile to see if they would sponsor something like that, which can be different. Sometimes Fulbright grantees reach out to an organization and that organization already has some things that they would like to do. And then the Fulbright person can kind of plug into that. But the other option is to just create your own, choose your own adventure, and then try and get someone, convince them to work with you on that.
Got it. So it was like a collaborative effort, but you were kind of the Fulbright scholar that was going to go and actually set up the program. That's awesome.
Yeah, it is cool because you're out there on your own with this project and you do have a research mentor, but it gives you a lot of autonomy to really bring this project to fruition. And I just loved that. I kind of loved that it was unstructured, and it kind of was an eye opener for me.
How did you go about implementing the project? Like, once you got there, what did it look like? You know, what were kind of the outcomes? What were the struggles? Tell me a little bit more about it.
Sure. So I think the project was to go to 10 different schools and perform case studies. So I was often giving a workshop where I would teach students who had no programming experience how to build their first video game, and kind of writing about that experience and then designing based on kind of what I was seeing in the classroom, seeing if I could design better ways to introduce these concepts to students. So I think the biggest challenge of a project like this is getting into schools as a foreigner. And I just didn't really know what I didn't know. So I spent the first month reaching out to all these teachers. And my special trick was I would offer to buy them coffee and lunch. And slowly just made a few connections here and there that then connected me to other people. And I knew I had to front load that outreach effort because it takes time to get to know people and to let them offer to, I don't know, for a school administrator to say, sure, you can come teach classes here. So that was the most difficult part. And I started that really early. And then once I was into schools, it was really easy to teach, honestly, because students were so engaged with the material. You could just see their faces light up when they got their video games working for the first time. So that was definitely a highlight of the project, was working with the students.
I'm sure that, you know, they were super excited for an opportunity like that. That sounds really cool. What was, I guess, in the end, did you put together kind of a, I'm guessing like a recommendation of what you had learned from teaching these classes on how this could be implemented on a wider scale? Or what was the kind of the outcome of the time you spent there?
Yeah. So part of my research grant was also creating a portfolio because I knew I wanted to, I knew I'd be applying for jobs afterwards. So I created a website for my research where everything lives. It's startupschools.cl. And I wrote, I kind of wrote my findings, which was that students, and this is not anything new, but I just really found the power of project-based education, where instead of, you know, the worksheet model or teaching, getting students to an answer you've predetermined, you give them an open-ended project and act more of a coach and help them get to a finalized submission. And so for the students, that was oftentimes these video games. And I think computer science, teaching computer science, kind of lends itself nicely to that form of teaching because it's so much easier to learn to program through projects and through doing it yourself. So I became really enamored with this constructionist theory of education and really believe that we need to rethink schools a little bit in that we should give students projects that are multidisciplinary and challenging and support them through the completion of those projects instead of, you know, these modular bounded assignments.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think especially at least for computer science and the technical skills that I've picked up over the course of my career, I had tried many times to do something like a Code Academy where I take an online class and it walks me through like, this is how you declare variables. This is how you create a loop without any context on like how I could use this in an actual project. I would always start and then inevitably just get bored with it in like a week. And it wasn't until I had a work project or like a personal project to work on where I had some particular goal or product in mind and I could just play around and work through the problems however I could to figure it out to get to that point. I feel like I learned so much more and I just had much more intrinsic motivation while I was working on the projects.
Totally.
So before we move on from Chile, I want to ask you to tell us a bit about the van.
Sure. So when I first got to Chile, I was really excited about the Fulbright grant and all of my research, but I also saw this as my year abroad that I'd always wanted to do. And you have freedom living in another country to perform weird social experiments that might be a little bit more difficult to do in the US. And so I'd always been interested in minimalism and alternative living and had spent the time before my Fulbright grant actually driving from California all the way down to Chile along the Panamericana. And that sounds really crazy, but it was actually instrumental to my Fulbright research because my Spanish level was really basic, and driving through Central America and South America, I got my Spanish to where it needed to be to teach. And during that trip, I saw all these people with vans and how they had everything they needed to survive within the space of a car or the footprint of a car. So I decided I needed to do it and that during my Fulbright, this would be the perfect time to experiment with alternative living. So I used my first Fulbright check to buy a van. It was a Toyota Hiace, 1998. And it was already converted when I got it. And it was a really great decision because you learn so much about being adaptable and living with less. And I actually, it was great for my research because I did some schools in the metropolitan region and then some schools further south. So because I didn't rent an apartment, I could be flexible and go do that. So even though it sounds a little bit extreme, I really think the van was, it was a great learning experience. Don't know if I need to do it again, but also good for the research project. It was like a mobile research station.
I love it. I think that if there was ever a time to do it, that was definitely the time. And also just the fact of conducting a social experiment while you're doing this other government-funded research project, it just sounds like you are someone who likes to be conducting these experiments, whether it's on the school children of Chile or on your own living situation.
Yeah, it was, I do like to experiment. And I think it's easier to do something like that when you're already traveling because you're already out of your comfort zone.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think too, traveling in general, especially for people who are just starting off in their careers, it's a great way to gain perspective into how kind of the world outside of our world works. And if you can kind of adapt yourself to working alongside other places in the world, it makes you that much better of a kind of an employee or when you come back home too.
Totally.
So I got what I wanted out of the van, and now we want to kind of pivot and talk about college. So could you tell us a bit about where you went to school and what you studied?
Sure. So I went to the University of Pennsylvania in Philly, and I studied in the business school, the Wharton School, which I felt like a fish out of water there because it's very finance oriented, and that didn't really inspire me. I wasn't interested in that at all. So I concentrated in operations and information management, which sounds weird, but it was the technical programming-y major for the business students. And I also concentrated in marketing. And so when I was doing the core curriculum and I had to take finance, accounting, that the kind of New York-y style business stuff, I really hated it. And I got an internship my junior year at a startup and kind of remembered why I went to business school in the first place. California is so startup oriented and more creative, not as New York financy. So senior year, I started taking all of the programming classes that were available to us in the business school and then started enjoying my classes and my studies a lot more. So it was kind of a backward experience in that I joined business school as a Bay Area, as someone native to the Bay Area and wanting to work here, and then went to the East Coast, was a little bit shell-shocked, but was able to take more interesting classes by senior year that were more tech-focused.
I can totally relate to that. I, at UCSB, while not the typical East Coast finance education, UCSB doesn't have a business school, so the degree program that most people take as the business substitute is economics. And for my first 2 years, I was just so bored. And all the career paths that they push you into are really just accounting and investment banking. So I was doing like investment banking interviews, and I was meeting all these, you know, people from Goldman and Wells, and I was just like, I don't want to work with you. And so luckily I kind of found the equivalent at UCSB, which is the technology management program. And that set me along the path to working at Graphic, which is where we met you. So could you tell us a bit about how you went from college to Graphic?
Sure. So I was at the startup fair at Penn, and I met these two guys from Santa Barbara, And I went to their info session and really, really thought that what they were working on was interesting. It was Find the Best at the time. So kind of a branding nightmare, but I liked what they were working on and they seemed smart. And that internship was like your classic internship where you have an intern class and they were all starting at the same time. It's kind of like another version of college orientation. And we did all these fun intern events and a hackathon. And I really enjoyed that. So I came back to work at Find the Best full time. And yeah, that's where I met you guys.
So pretty typical path into tech in the sense of the intern class and the, you know, finding the company at an info session. Could you speak a little bit to how much Penn kind of encouraged the path into startups? Was it a common path for a lot of students, or were you kind of unique in the fact that you ended up and going and working at a startup after you graduated?
I'm sure there's a lot of Penn students doing it, and I'm sure engineering, there's a lot of people coming out west, but to me it felt like I was the only one, which I think Penn senior year just feels like everyone goes into consulting or iBanking. So yes, it did feel like I was the only one, but I think that is changing and that there's more of a startup initiative to get students out here and working on different things. But I would say the Penn culture is still very finance, New York, Wall Street. That's kind of the main, it's kind of a pipeline right into those companies.
Yeah, I figured that was still the case. So you make it out west to Graphic and you meet Brendan first. I wasn't started there when you first started. What were you doing as kind of your first role at Graphic?
Sure. I was working, I think I started on the travel vertical, and our job in the product manager path was to ingest all this data and put it on this platform so that we could help people make these data-driven decisions. So we learned how to use this program called Kettle, or like, I think it's Pentaho Data Integration. And it's an ETL tool that allows you to use like a series of visual steps to analyze data. And so that we had a bunch of the product interns. We were all learning that tool at the same time. So they gave us these projects, taught us how to do ETL, and we were just living and breathing data analysis for at least that first year.
And you didn't really come into the job with any kind of proper like coding skills, did you?
I had taken a Python class in college and then a different programming class, but computer science skills were rudimentary at best.
Okay, yeah, I just wanted to make sure that was clear, because part of why Graphic was such a cool place to work for all of us is a lot of the people who succeeded there were non-technical to some sort of extent coming out of college, and the company did an awesome job of onboarding interns and new hires who didn't come from a computer science background and making them these relatively technically competent product managers. And it was just kind of a well-oiled machine of training and peer mentoring and things like that. And it set a lot of people up for success. And it's something that, you know, when Brendan and I vet companies, we look a lot into, you know, what does their intern and new hire onboarding look like? And we look for things that kind of remind us of Graphic in a sense.
Yeah, I think that's super important, because in engineering as well, there's less and less people want to take on junior engineers or provide education. I think maybe that's more true in engineering, but it is so important to teach on the job. And I think it's important. I think it's better to hire extremely motivated people who learn quickly than just someone who has the exact skills that fit the bill.
Definitely. Definitely.
Yeah, Jamie, I actually wanted to talk a little bit more about how you did pick up those technical skills. So, you know, I know that at Graphic, they were very good at training us on working with data. But now you're in the software engineering role. And in Chile, you were doing freelance web design. So how did you end up picking up the skills that you needed to do the job that you have now?
That's a good question. I realized in Chile, and I think also a little bit before, that I wanted a career path or a set of skills that could come with me wherever I went. So a portfolio or your GitHub profile, something you can stand behind. And so after Fulbright, the freelancing I enjoyed, but it was really just building a portfolio to show what I'd learned so far so that I could get a full-time role that was going to teach me everything I needed to get my start in the industry. Because you can kind of only go so far with engineering, and then your first job as an engineer is a big jump in terms of collaborating on a large code base and just taking your skills to the next level. So during that freelancing period, I was taking online video courses about how to learn React and how to build things in React. I was studying computer science fundamentals, which I didn't really get in college, and creating this website with all of the web pages that I designed so that when I did start looking for full-time roles, I could have something to show, which, yeah, everyone needs that first portfolio. And the best way, I think most people freelance, and it was pretty nice I got to do the freelancing down in Chile.
How did you get set up with clients? Like, I mean, especially, you know, your first client where you may not have that portfolio yet. How did that happen?
It all happened through Mary Lou McFarlane. She's one of those connector people, and I also work with her on my nonprofit stuff. She presented me to pretty much every client I got. So knowing that one person that's going to open the door for you is super important. And the other thing was that I charged dirt low rates because I knew that I was just learning and I wanted to over deliver, and people would have this low price tag, but I would work my butt off to give them good results. And that also made me feel more comfortable in my projects, just knowing that I was giving them a really, really, really fair price. So it was kind of a combination of both, that I had one person who was telling everyone that I was web developing, and then once I got on the phone with them and gave them quotes, it was pretty easy to land those jobs because I was a pretty, pretty cheap laborer.
Yeah. I mean, you definitely have to start somewhere. So that was smart.
Yeah. I think there's different ways you could do it. Sometimes I think charging too low of rates, people see you as that quality of work. And I know other people who just start off charging more. And I think it could go either way, but I just felt more comfortable starting low.
Right. Especially when you're still kind of learning a bit about the craft on the job.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense. So, okay. how was the transition and job hunt into engineering? Because I know, you know, a few months or so before you ended up at Parabola, you'd reached out to me, and I know you were looking for a few different roles in tech, you know, product and some other roles. So how did you end up at Parabola, and what was the process hard to get in, to get an interview? How was it for you?
I think coming back to the Bay Area and looking for an engineering role without the degree and without knowing how valuable my experience would be was scary, just because I didn't know. It seemed like there weren't that many junior engineering roles, or and I think that's for a lot of reasons. People don't want their senior engineers to be training new people. They want their senior engineers to be engineering. And there also is this huge fear around junior engineers that they're going to cost the company a ton of money and mistakes and things like that. And I think, just given my work in education, that people can learn these skills. And that was kind of a frustrating thing for me about the industry. And I just started interviewing right when I got back. And there weren't as many junior engineering roles as I thought there would be. And some the technical interviews, it's some of them you do great, and other ones you tank completely. And the trick is to just do a lot. And I use cracking the coding interview, not necessarily because it's not a ton of tricks that just get you through the problems. It's more about structuring your answers and helping you walk your interviewer through your thought process. And so I found actually one job down in Santa Cruz that I was really excited about. And as I was finalizing things with them, I was pretty much signed on to work with them. Parabola found me through Hired, and they were really excited about me and rushed me through the interview process. And once I did my on-site interview with them, I liked them a lot more and came to work here in San Francisco instead. So I think it was scary initially. The technical interviews are scary, but it's practice, and a lot of people are looking for engineers now. So although it is intimidating, there is just this huge demand. So you can get interviews, and then with practice, something works out.
I think that's a really important point you made about focusing on the process of the interview, which I think we work with a lot of candidates that are, they want to know like questions, like specific questions that they could be asked. And especially when it's a problem solving type of interview, like it's much more important that you learn exactly as you said, to like share your thought process, to structure your answer in a logical fashion, lay out your assumptions, work through the problem, and explain your thinking clearly. I think that's so much more important than just understanding or knowing what one of the questions might be, because, you know, the questions could be anything.
Yeah. And I think responding, if you share your thought process, you could have the wrong answer, but they could like the way you approached it. The other thing I was going to add is the way you respond to feedback in an interview can be, if you're flexible and saying, oh, that is a good point, let me rethink this, that can be a good opportunity to show how you would work with someone on the job. And where I work now, Parabola, it's a seed stage startup. So I know a huge thing that they were looking for was someone who could take feedback or take, you know, doubts, I guess, about your process and address them and rethink your answers so that it's not, you're not just steadfast in your beliefs, but you're open to restructuring and redesigning.
100%. Yeah, that's so important. What was it about Parabola that made you decide to go with them at the last minute? Like, I know that you said you were excited about this other company. We don't have to talk about that company, but like, what made you choose Parabola? Like, what stood out to you?
Yeah. So one of the things that I still love about the team is how supportive they were throughout the interview process and how if we were working together on a coding problem, if they were addressing a concern about something I had wrote or something I had assumed, it came from a place of support and respect. And I think there were some coding interviews where people were just rude or they're just trying to poke holes in you. And I knew for me, the most important thing was getting a job that was going to support me through my learning process and help me as a new engineer. And the Parabola people were really smart. They seemed, at least from my junior engineering perspective, really knowledgeable about the programming languages that they were working in. And they weren't making me feel stupid. They were kind of saying, oh, actually, this is how you do it. And just that communication and the way that we work together was something that got me really excited about joining their team.
I've never understood that interviewing style where people will just stonewall you and and or just like tear you apart and make you feel like an idiot. It doesn't reflect the working environment. I mean, most times it doesn't reflect the working environment that people actually work in. And I find it so strange that people feel like an interview is an appropriate time to like act that way when you would never treat your coworker that way, or you would never interact with your coworker once they were hired that way. I always thought that was so strange.
Yeah, totally. I think I'm really lucky because I feel like our office environment, our work culture is people just naturally respect you. And that feels like, oh, everywhere should be that way. But I don't think that's the case.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's not always true. Okay. As I mentioned before, I definitely want to talk about the nonprofit you co-founded, Women in Sports Tech. So what was the inspiration there and what went into that?
Yeah. So a year ago, Mary Lou McFarlane, who I was talking about before, approached me with her idea, which was to start a nonprofit that would be aimed at creating growth opportunities for women in sports tech. And we define sports tech pretty broadly. And I got really excited about it. Since I've started working on it, I've only seen the need for organizations like this more and more. And I said yes. I was in Chile at the time and was working on the technical piece of Women in Sports Tech. So building the website, building our jobs portal, designing the logo, business cards, investor pitch deck, that kind of piece. And since then, it's had really great product market fit in the sense that we're not doing any marketing, but we're getting people signing up every week. I guess one of the big things that we've been working on is our fellowships program. So in our first year, we thought we were only going to offer two, but then we managed to scare up extra money to do three fellowships. So these girls, two of them were in college undergrad, one was in graduate school. they got $5,000 to do a project at a company that was tech-related. And we saw this as getting these girls an in and giving them experience that was going to then fuel the rest of their career. So that's our major initiative. And right now we're cranking to get things ready for 2019. And we're going to open applications soon. So that's really exciting. And I've since starting it, I've only seen the need for organizations like this more and more. Once you open your eyes, you kind of can't close them.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. That's awesome. Could you give an example of a sports tech like company?
Yeah. So, for example, like Nike would be a sports tech company. They're creating sports products, but their core competency is kind of their design and technological savviness. Or for example, the NCAA, if they're working with a wearable technology company to track their athletes, we would see that as sports tech. Sports teams who are using technology and that to fuel their stadium experience. It kind of is there are sports companies that use technology and then technology companies that are aimed at the kind of athletics industry. We like I said, we define it pretty broadly.
Got it. What's an example of one of your grantees and like what did they end up, what were they able to do through the program?
Yeah. So Fiona McCormick was one of our grantees and she did her project at Doremus. So that's a branding agency here in the city. But during her project, she really liked what we were doing at Women in Sports Tech. And we were able to also supervise her project in addition to her mentor at Doremus. And she worked on a podcast for us and produced the whole thing, set up interviews, did all of the editing, which I'm sure you guys know is no small feat. And so at the end of her fellowship, she could point to this podcast that she had pitched, launched, and created. So I think stuff like that, where you're in college, but you are given this ownership of this project, that is something that tech gives you. Whereas in a lot of other industries, you're going to be the analyst and you're just working on other people's initiatives and doing, you know, the ground level things. Fiona really was able to take this fellowship and run with it. And now she volunteers with us at Women in Sports Tech and she's a contributing awesome member of our team.
Yeah. Putting together a podcast, you're right, is no small feat, as Zach and I are learning right now. So maybe you could connect us with her and she'd have some tips.
Yeah.
Also, we'll be sure to include all the information about women in sports tech for any of our women listeners who might be interested in what you guys do and maybe even applying for the fellowship program. And I know you have a job board on there as well, which is awesome.
Yes, that would be great. We are currently creating the applications and they'll be open mid-January of the new year.
That is awesome. And I think you mentioned that Parabola is hiring as well.
Yeah, we for Parabola, we're hiring a growth marketer and I think we're always looking for good engineers.
Okay, Jamie, we are going to be wrapping up in a few minutes, but I just wanted to ask a couple more quick questions. The first is, if you have any advice for someone who is in college, who is thinking about working in tech and, you know, maybe ending up working as an engineer, is there any just general advice or resources or anything that you would say to them?
So I'll just give the advice that I would give myself. I got really excited about the idea of having a portfolio that can speak for you and for your work. So as early as possible, having whether it's a GitHub or a personal website where you can collect your projects, your any type of work you've done and showcase it. I think that makes interviewing so much easier because you can kind of, like I said, you can stand behind that. I also think if you do take an art class in college, add things like that in there, or if you're blogging in your spare time, all of those things show that you're a person who does things and puts them out into the world. So the more you can start that early, and even if it looks crappy in the beginning, just keep working on it. In a couple years, you'll have something that you're really proud of, and it will make interviewing a lot less scary.
Yes, definitely. Okay, the last thing that I wanted to ask you is, what is one cool thing that you're into right now? So it doesn't have to be work or tech related. Could just be anything. Could be an album. Could be a movie. Could be a new hobby. What's one cool thing you're into right now?
Ooh, that's a good question. So I've been thinking a lot about my favorite things that I read and listened to in 2018. If you haven't seen it, the movie Blindspotting is a beautiful film about Oakland and how the tech industry is changing our community here. And I became infatuated with this movie. I saw one of the actors, Rafael Casal, at Yerba Buena Art Center and heard him speak. That movie just really inspired me. I think it's a must watch. And I've also been reading a bunch of interesting stuff. I'm reading the new Michael Pollan book, How to Change Your Mind, and that is super interesting as well.
I just finished The Omnivore's Dilemma, which is another one of his books, and I love that.
Yeah. He's super, I love the way he does nonfiction because it's not dense, and the books he wrote on food changed how I think about food and what's healthy, and you get a weird look into how warped the American perspective is on food. So he's a really interesting guy.
Great. Well, thank you for that. So Blindspotting and then Michael Pollan's new book. We'll also have those in the show notes. Jamie, thank you so much for coming on the show. This was very enlightening. You have an awesome story, and we wish you the best of luck.
Thanks, guys. It was super fun.
I'm glad you liked it. Thank you so much.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening. If you're looking to break into tech, visit our website at secretsauce.tech and join our Job Seeker Network. Every week, we'll send you a new podcast with our interview notes highlighting our favorite insights from the episode. You'll also receive a daily tech industry briefing, get access to exclusive job opportunities, and an invitation to join our Slack community. All right, see ya!